Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to CoHealth Checkup, a 30-minute radio show that promises thoughtful debate and lively banter about workplace wellness and employee benefits trends. I'm Carol Harnett, a health and disability and employee benefits consultant, speaker, and writer. I'm also the president for the Council for Disability Awareness, and you can find me at the Twitter handle at Carol Harnett, and also at Human Resource Executive, where I write the employee benefits column. Unfortunately, my co-host, Fran Melmed, is unable to join us today. As you know, Fran and I have done a number of shows in caregiving, and our thoughts go out to Fran as she is in the final stages of caregiving for her mother, and she has given me permission to share that with this audience. For those of you who don't know Fran, she's the founder of Context, a consulting firm that specializes in workplace wellness, and you can also find her at the Twitter handle at F.E. Melmed, as well as at contextcommunication.com. But I have two guests on the line with me who I will be referencing and talking to in a minute, but let me introduce today's show. We wanted to talk about the topic of employee salary and benefits, and really something that happened on January 2nd is what spurred Fran and I to want to take this topic on. In fact, I actually wound up writing a benefits column about it. And to give you background, what we've been spending a lot of time when we talk about human resources and employee benefits in the workplace is we've been talking about employers who are trying to get out of the benefits business. Many people point to a combination of the 2008 recession and the passage of the Affordable Care Act, among other trends, that led to a trend that we've seen over the past several years of stagnated employee compensation and decreased benefits packages, all in the name of cutting back on expenses and hopefully improving corporate profitability. But as I referenced a little bit before, things seemed to shift a little bit, at least in the Twitterverse, on January 2nd when Bobby Fry, who is one of our guests and one of the co-owners of Bar Marco in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, tweeted that his restaurant would stop accepting gratuities from its patrons and, starting in April of this year, move its 20 full-time employees to a $35,000 base salary and provide full health coverage, vacation days, and private chairs, among other things. And the internet just exploded for a period of time around that story. And basically on the heels of it, about 2 weeks later, Hartford, Connecticut-based Aetna announced that it would raise its minimum wage to $16 per hour. And interestingly enough, it's about what Bobby's going to pay his employees, because it comes out to just a little over $33,000 a year. And they, too, are going to start this in April of 2015. The health insurer is also going to give approximately 7,000 employees access to health benefits next year. That should lower their out-of-pocket costs by up to $4,000. So I am pleased to also reference that we have economist Jan Zielinski with us. And Jan, along with Justin Wolfers, released a paper pretty much coincident with the Aetna announcement that reviewed a headline question: under what circumstances can raising the pay of lower-skilled workers at large corporations lead to general improvements in productivity? As I've already referenced, Bobby Fry is one of the co-owners of Bar Marco in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and Jan Zielinski has been a research analyst at the Peterson Institute for International Economics since October 2014, and he works with Senior Fellow Justin Wolfers as well as Senior Fellow Paolo Mauro. So welcome both Jan and Bobby.
Thank you, Carol. Great to be here.
And Bobby, you're there too, right? Oh, maybe he's not. Let me go back out and see what's going on, because I thought I had called him in. Bobby, are you there? He looks like he's on board, but we just can't seem to hear him. Okay, well, then we're going to keep going. So, you know, I was going to start with Bobby on, but we're going to be flexible, and we are going to actually, maybe I'm going to move to this idea of your paper first. And in your paper, you and Justin Wolfers opened with the Alfred Marshall quote: any change in the distribution of wealth, which gives more to the wage receivers and less to the capitalists, is likely, other than other things being equal, to hasten the increase of material production. How do higher wages improve employee productivity and profitability of businesses and operations? And corporations, I'm sorry. So how do you think higher wages improve employee productivity and the profitability?
Sure. So, Carol, as you mentioned, we wrote a literature review where we have looked at past academic studies. This literature on employee compensation and productivity started in the early 1980s with a paper by Janet Yellen. And since then, economists have developed theories, and they have also looked at data, kind of having an intuition that employees receive... Yes.
Great. Go ahead. Keep going, Jan.
Yes. As I was saying, economists wrote this theory in 1980s. They called it the efficiency wage theory, and the idea was very basic, which was that if an employee really values the job because he or she feels appreciated and does not want to lose a particular job, because good work environment, including high wages and possibly benefits, this worker will be intrinsically motivated to perform better, and therefore there will be a lesser need for the employer to monitor, offer bonuses. So basically, with a wage which is flat but high, the theory was that the employee would try to work harder, would try to build new skills, would be less likely to quit, and sort of keeping an eye on other job openings, and would also try to provide better customer service, which ultimately is a softer side of business, which is sometimes difficult to observe or measure directly. But we do have evidence that as employers have increased wages, things like customer service have improved.
That's wonderful. Let me, John,
yes.
If you don't mind, let me just check in. Bobby, can we hear you now?
Sure.
Bobby? Can you hear me?
I can. Okay. So I'm going to interrupt Jan. I know. It was a little scary there for a moment. I'm going to interrupt Jan. I'm sure you could hear his answer to my opening question to him.
Yes.
And I want to get you in the mix as well, because obviously, and I think Jan is interested in well as what you're doing. So let me ask this question. Yes. You know, in the restaurant industry, you know, lots of us are interested even more, I think, than ever in food and restaurants, particularly with the explosion of celebrity chefs. Yet despite these, you know, very high-profile people in the restaurant industry, there's a steeped tradition of waitstaff receiving low minimum wage pay and, depending upon tips, and back-of-the-house staff is generally not paid that well either. You've just heard Jan's introduction to why you would want to pay lower-wage workers more money, but why did you and your co-owners make this shift to no gratuities, a base salary of $35,000, and very generous benefits?
Well, one of the interesting things, and I'll agree with Jan on that, is that, you know, you can't. I don't think you can start off with a quantitative approach. You have to kind of start off with history and common sense, and then quantify it over time a bit. So I think that kind of makes some people nervous, because there's not this like direct A to B relationship between paying workers more and actually, you know, spitting it in a formula and seeing what happens with productivity, because so much of it is qualitative, the improvements that happen. But for us, it was just more about, you know, being 3 years into business, trying to avoid the pitfalls. So I always say that, you know, economics is about, you know, history and using it to create strategy, essentially. So I always start off with history. And if you look at, you know, restaurants and seeing the fact that 70% or so fail within their first 3 years and 90% fail within the first 5 years, it's like, okay, well, we just turned 3 years old. I'd really like to make it past five. So let's take a look at the inefficiencies that that kind of befall these restaurants between that 3 to 5 year period. And a lot of them are, you know, you get burnt out, essentially. If you've made it 3 years, you obviously have quality food and quality service, so you know, probably wouldn't be around at all. You'd be in that 70% category. So what are these other things that we can avoid and make our operation more efficient to, you know, kind of avoid that between 3 and 5 year burnout? And for us, I mean, scheduling was a big part of it. So you're exactly right. The front and back of the house have this, like, weird juxtaposition where if the front of the house is very busy, they're happy because they're making more money, but at the same time, the back of the house then is working three times as hard for the same amount of money. Well, then when it's slow, the front of the house is very unhappy because they're not making any money, and the kitchen is, you know, inherently happier because they're getting caught up on work or doing prep work for the next day and getting paid the same amount of money. So you want to try to avoid that major problem that restaurants have. And then, you know, everybody wants to work Friday and Saturday night, obviously in the front of the house because you make the most amount of money there. So we wanted to incentivize everyone to be able to work, you know, for lifestyle balance or for quality life balance, to be able to be incentivized to work equally any day of the week, and which allows you to then have more full-time employees instead of having part-time employees to fill the gaps of the, you know, the less desirable shifts. So then you have a consistency of product and service that I think after 3 years most restaurants kind of lose because the owner is not, you know, the owner or the chef, if you're any good, you're not necessarily doing all the work yourself anymore. I'm not bartending every shift anymore. So it's really the only way to kind of secure that quality and of service and product on every plate. I mean, some of the worst restaurant experiences I've had are at some of the best restaurants to go to. And usually that's because if I'll go on a Tuesday or a Wednesday, the menu's not being executed the way that it was intended to. So while it's a great menu on paper, if you can't ensure that if I go in on Monday or Tuesday that it's going to be as great as it is on a Friday or Saturday, then, you know, what's the point?
Interesting.
So you're just mm-hmm. open to criticism.
You know, let's bring Jan into the conversation. And Jan, you wrote your paper after Aetna made its announcement, and they certainly are one of a handful of big companies we're seeing that are looking at this idea of raising the wages of lower-income employees. We've seen IKEA do it, The Gap, Starbucks, Costco, all around the same time frame. But the restaurant industry is new territory for this type of change. What do you see as the opportunities and potential pitfalls for Bobby and Bar Marco?
Yes, so I think that the rationale and motivation that Bobby described is absolutely fascinating, because one thing that we have observed is that there is this movement in the United States where some people believe that what you need to do is increase minimum wages through legislation or through some type of mandatory regulation. And on the other hand, you have some large corporations that believe that you should be seeing voluntary wage increases, so motivated by efficiency as well as worker well-being. I think it's great that some large firms are doing this. And what is even more interesting is when the smaller businesses, who sometimes have very low profit margins, are also able to accommodate worker schedules and to find ways to make workers work together and make the final experience of the customer better. So I think it's fascinating to hear that through paying a salary rather than relying on tips, you can have servers who do not fight to get the most attractive shifts over the weekends, but you can ensure that a good service will be provided throughout the week.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I just returned from a business trip, and so I was gone in the middle of the week. And so, Bobby, to your point, I realized I did not get as good service as I'm sure I normally would have if I was there at a different time. In fact, it definitely was a different experience. I actually have a question of both of you. I'm not really sure who to direct it to, but I think it's interesting, and I don't know if it's just simply a coincidence, that both Aetna and Bar Marco came to about the same salary point, which is you came, Bobby, to $35,000. Aetna came to a little over $33,000. Is there something significant about that number? Does it start to make this a livable wage for people?
I mean, I guess Dan, you probably have a better perspective on that as far as, you know, more broadly speaking. But where is Aetna located?
Well, Aetna's located all over the country, but their home office is in Hartford, Connecticut.
Hartford, yeah. Yeah, so, I mean, in bigger inner cities, that's not going to really be, you know, too livable. Pittsburgh, I'm actually in Austin right now. I'm down here enjoying the warmth and getting some inspiration for a couple of months and working remotely. But that salary would definitely hold up here. and create a, you know, a great lifestyle. It definitely holds up in Pittsburgh, but I mean, San Francisco or New York or LA or something like that, I'm sure it wouldn't quite be enough, but I don't know if there's a significance. I mean, what's the poverty line, like 22,000 or something like that? So what is that, maybe percentages like 40% above the poverty line or something like that? So I don't know. That's an interesting question. But
Jan, is there something significant, Jan, about $35,000?
So I think there is a recognition then that in many areas in the United States, for a single person to start a household is becoming increasingly difficult. So you basically need at least a two-person household. You need a person who stays with a roommate or with their partner so that they can live comfortably on the sort of average or lower average wage in the United States. So I think as you get to the $16 territory, it becomes a little bit easier not to have to rely on these alternative arrangements and to perhaps become more independent, live alone, and start also saving for the future.
Yeah, I actually know that when Mark Bertolini announced the change in salary, he did it company-wide, but he based himself at the Florida call center where most of the lower-paid employees were, and they said it was quite moving to watch employees stand up and voluntarily talk about what this meant to them. And maybe in Florida, obviously, that would have a bigger impact than perhaps, you know, a bigger city. So kind of getting, I guess, back on track. Bobby, when you sent this tweet out, as we've talked about off the radio show, you received a lot of pickup, and particularly in the food and restaurant industry media, and then it grew out from there. Actually, interesting enough, I have no idea why I was reading in a food industry blog, but that's how I found out about it. So I'm curious, how have other restaurants, especially in Pittsburgh, responded to this change in how you're going to treat your employees?
Complete radio silence.
Hmm.
So I'm not sure why. I don't really care. You know, it's definitely not a strategy that's right for everyone. We've got 30 seats in our main dining room, 10 seats in our, you know, fine dining room in the basement. You know, generally speaking, though, on productivity, I mean, if you look at, you know, let's go back to history again, right? And like the most successful companies in history, I mean, what I think Google makes the most per employee and most revenue per employee of any company in the world. I'm not sure if that's still true, but it was as of a couple years ago. And look at how they treat their employees. So, and then conversely, let's go to, say, a McDonald's or something like that, right? And you start off with this intuitive notion that you walk in and see 20 people doing the job of 10 people and being underpaid for it. Now, I don't know, maybe, Jan, maybe you know, I don't know if the tax break situation is such that you get tax breaks for the more people that you hire, or if there are incentives in the tax realm to say, hey, let's give tax incentives for the more people you hire over $35,000 a year is one way to kind of look at how you can encourage more strategic operations for these larger companies. But being down here and going to an In-N-Out Burger for my first time and seeing the place sparkling clean. Yeah, it's incredible, right? And, like, sure, they don't have a 99-cent menu. They have a $3 menu. But guess what? All of their employees start out at $10.50. They all look, like, sparkling clean. They're all working hard and working together. And it's like the whole teamwork makes the dream work thing going on. And you're like, wow, you know, maybe we should start quantifying why they're so much more productive, not if they will be more productive, and, you know, start looking at that for Target when you go in and see, or Walmart and see maybe twice the employees all being paid under the poverty line, and start thinking about how we can incentivize larger companies to relook at their strategies and you know, and have some more quality workforce.
Mm-hmm. You know, so Jan, what is the economic, you know, as an economist, when you hear what Bobby's having to say and you look at this issue and you made the reference that, you know, perhaps it's the market itself that should drive higher wages rather than the government, if the restaurant industry has gone silent on what Bobby's doing, is that what do you hope happens from that? Is should they watch him be successful and then want to mimic him, and will that also benefit them?
No, I think that would be great if people in the industry were watching Bobby's strategy and if they learned and tried to emulate. But I would like just like to go back briefly to Bobby's point, because he mentioned Google, which that is a corporation that has a good reputation. I don't want to talk about the company too much, but let me mention my recent experience visiting a couple of friends of mine who work for Google. What they mentioned to me is that while they do appreciate the some of the aspects of the work environment, such as having a cafeteria and an environment where they do not have to worry about running out of the office and eat lunch, I think they also understand that even though this is packaged and presented as a worker benefit, it is actually something that, in their perspective, ultimately benefits their employer. It benefits the corporation because people stay on site when they have lunch inside Google. They ultimately end up talking about work, so they discuss how to improve the products that the company is creating. They talk about ways to improve services. So something that often looks like it's a benefit for the worker, it often works both ways, and ultimately depends on the framing, and often the employees themselves can see that the corporation is just run more efficiently if workers do not have to worry about things like getting something to eat in the middle of the day.
So it's a reciprocal advantage then in both cases.
Absolutely.
I would agree 100%. This is definitely not some altruistic move on our part. It's definitely something that we see benefits both the employees and the ownership, and as it should. I mean, I've got a kind of a cold-hearted economist view of a lot of things as well. So being an economics student and listening to Freakonomics a good bit and staying up on markets from my Wall Street days, I definitely have, I don't believe in, altruistic business models. So,
Go ahead, Jan.
I was going to say, it really sounds like what you are doing is that you are ensuring that the incentives of workers and the business are aligned, so that there is less room for conflict.
Definitely taking it. I was just going to say that I think maybe the only difference between that perspective and any other business perspective is time, right? Like, what time are you planning for? Are you planning for today and tomorrow, or are you planning for 10 and 20 years? So I kind of think that a lot of people that have a mismatched incentives between employee and ownership kind of are just looking at the wrong time frame and looking at too short of a time frame.
Yeah, just reminded me of something somebody said to me yesterday. It's the comparison of the sprint mentality versus the marathon mentality. And it seems like you're in more of a marathon mentality with what you're trying to do with your workers. And what struck me is, and I actually want to follow up on it, because, again, Aetna's doing a very similar thing, not exactly the same, but you didn't just give your employees a base salary. You've actually given them a benefits package. You're giving them full health care. You're giving them 10 vacation days. You're giving them a guaranteed 9 off, 2 other days off, and you're closed on Sundays. So why did you go beyond salary, which I personally think is great, but why did you go beyond salary, and particularly why did you zero in on the health benefit out of everything else?
Well, there were definitely two sides of the health benefit. I mean, almost everybody that works there, I mean, we just, the three owners just turned 30 years old, so pretty much the whole team is under 30, so you can add the healthcare without it being, too expensive with our current team anyway. And, there's the side that you want people to be healthy, clearly. And second, you want them to be able to talk, with their families as if it's a real career. I mean, you need to understand parts of at least 4 different languages to be able to serve our wine. So these are smart, sharp, you know, workers that we have, and you know, they deserve to have the same healthcare opportunities that and pride in their job that any other professional would have. So looking at the cost benefit of that is, it was pretty you know, pretty much a no brainer. That and the you know, the owners need healthcare as well. So we're all kind of in the same boat. I mean, there's really not much of a separation between ownership and management with the way we run. That's why I say it may not be perfect for everyone out of the gate, or that everybody needs their own strategy for this. And then as far as like the bonus or the profit sharing concerned, is, you know, once we're making over, you know, a certain amount, and if we cross that threshold, we don't want to limit the upside to where we're just getting crushed and you have the same morale or you know, you would have the same morale problem in that fourth and fifth year that other poor restaurants or restaurants that failed would have. But you also want to, you know, some of the most useless positions in restaurants are assistant managers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're essentially taking away, like, the server isn't capable of doing a lot of these tasks, or the bartender or the kitchen folks aren't capable of doing these, like, tasks. And you have this, like, assistant manager position that's just, like, I mean, like, the least efficient position possible. So eliminating that salary that you would have to have in your fourth and fifth year just to make sure that everything gets done, this cleanup person, and, you know, making incentivizing, you know, the full-time staff that we already have to keep an eye on these things, like how many towels are we ordering? How many limes did we use this week? What's the price of limes? What are the price of lemons? You know, food companies or food purveyors, you know, almost all of our stuff comes from, you know, local farms and things like that. But the few things that we use the big food companies for, like potatoes, onions, and citrus, and, you know, they know that, and they change the prices on them as frequently as possible to try to catch you. And so, you know, somebody's got to keep an eye on these citrus prices, and we need to change the cocktail menu. Like all that, in all those articles that came out last spring on the price of limes and how the cartel was controlling the lime business,
mm-hmm,
that was
mm-hmm.
all total BS. It was mm-hmm. Cinco de Mayo. So, understanding, I mean, if you've read Ryan Holiday's book, Trust Me, I'm Lying, which I'm sure some of these big food marketing executives had, they just, like, sold the most interesting, awesome story ever to bloggers who need clicks to get paid, and made up some, like, cartel story on Cinco de Mayo. And what happened a week after Cinco de Mayo? Price of limes drops right back to where it was. So, you know, but having some kind of, you know, empowerment saying, hey, instead of paying all these people to do all of this, you know, non-productive work, let's just give you some incentives to make sure you're keeping an eye on these things. And we're going to have a bi-monthly financial meeting, and you'll get to see what we spent money on, what we didn't. So over time, you know, it's completely up to you. If you want to help us keep these things in line, you get paid more money. If not, you know, we're still going to be happy with, you know, our current, we're within our current percentages anyway. So,
it's a great insider perspective, because I think particularly people who are fortunate enough to be able to travel to some degree or to go out to eat or out for a drink can relate to what you're talking about. I want to close with a question that I think both of you can address, and I know certainly you can, Bobby, because I am going to start with you on this. You know, a company like Aetna, when they made really a wonderful announcement, I mean, from what I've heard from people who were there, there were employees who were openly choked up and tearful when they heard the announcement, but it was a complete surprise. And the difference that you've done at Bar Marco is you involved the employees in the creation of your package, both the salary and the benefits. Can you talk about why you decided to do that versus, you know, why, I know, granted, Aetna is a huge corporation, but why a corporation might surprise employees with this news?
Yeah, I mean, I'd be interested to see if they surprised all employees, or, I mean, I'm sure there was a brain trust there that put this idea together. I don't, you know, so I'm sure there was some involvement there. I mean, we were able to do it for a couple of reasons. One, you know, they're smarter than us on many levels, and trying to see, you know, build this plan together is, you know, the giving them these incentives and these things to see if they're even interested in that path to take on those responsibilities. But you know, and for us too, it's, we're looking for sustainability. Nobody's ever going to make $1 million off of a 30-seat restaurant. So we've got, you know, other things to pack in life. So making, you know, them a part of the decision was just natural. But I'm really curious, what happened to Aetna's stock price after they made that announcement?
That's a great question. I actually don't know. Jan, do you know how what happened to Aetna?
So it was actually quite stable. There was no big movement. There was sort of a small increase, which was nothing unusual. I think it just shows that investors correctly understood that this was not going to financially ruin the firm, but that this is just an improvement that they are introducing, and that hopefully will work out in the long term. Even though the total wage bill will increase. Most people who were reading about the news were not trading or shorting in any way. So I think the market interpretation was correct, and they just want to wait and see what will be ultimately the consequence later.
Yeah, I will think it'll be interesting to follow retention of Aetna employees, because they had gone through an acquisition,
right,
and they were doing some layoffs, but they were also losing some of their higher quality employees. So it will be interesting to see if their retention improves following this. So, gentlemen, any other final comments before we close? Yes, Bobby.
Oh no, I was just going back into the stock and to see. I was just curious. Like, you're breaking up a bit. You said that it went up just a bit.
It did, yes. So immediately following the announcement.
Was it on a lot of volume too? Was there a lot of volume trading in the stock?
There wasn't any apparent large volume change. No.
Huh. Okay. Cool.
Well, one good thing is the market didn't misinterpret it and take it the other way, that this was a mistake. So I'm going to look at that as a positive. Well, you know, we could go on and on, but as I look up at the clock, we are closing down on half an hour. So unfortunately, I'm going to have to say thank you to both of you, and certainly to our listeners, for what I find to be a really interesting and valuable conversation. The conference I just came from speaking at was actually in some ways the antithesis of this approach, where we were talking about, I was asked to comment on strategies around how to employers could spend less money on benefits. So I will tell you, thank you, this was refreshing. Tell our listeners that you certainly can listen to this show live, but you can also listen to it on demand, which we find these days most of our listeners do, and we can be found at Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, and Stitcher. I also want to remind our listeners that our next show will air on Wednesday, March 4th at 12 noon Eastern, and our guest will be Dr. Peter Mills, who is a friend and a colleague based out of the UK, and he will be commenting on the topic of health risk assessments, which have in some ways fallen out of favor, and he'll be referencing his research. So again, thank you so much to Jan Zielinski and to Bobby Fry. We appreciate your focus on the idea of improving employee salaries and benefits, and we'll really be interested to track particularly how this impacts Bar Marco, but also how it impacts companies like Aetna. So thank you both.
Thank you, Joe. Have a good day.
You too. Enjoy, everyone.